All right, 2 minute meditation. Creative intelligence.
Creative intelligence.
We acknowledge your presence in this room.
We acknowledge your presence in this room.
We ask that you guide us and direct us.
We ask that you guide us and direct us.
Please set aside.
Please set aside.
What we think we know.
What we think we know.
About resentment inventory.
About resentment inventory.
Fear inventory.
Fear inventory.
And sex inventory.
And sex inventory.
So we can have an open mind.
So we can have an open mind.
And a new experience.
And a new experience.
With all these things.
With all these things.
Help us see the truth.
Help us see the truth.
Amen.
Amen.
I want to read I just stumbled across this recently, but it's become one of my favorite things to read. It's by a woman named Marianne Williamson. Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You're a child of the universe. Your playing small does not serve the world. There is nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We are all meant to shine as children do. We are born to manifest the glory of the Creator that is within us. It's not just in some of us, it's in every single one of us. And as we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our own fear, our presence automatically liberates others. You know, I'm convinced that underlying resentment is fear, and underlying our gross misconduct in relationships is fear. It permeates in the big, I love how the big book describes it, the fabric of our existence is shot through with it. And we can't even see it sometimes. And as we go through this process of sharing some resentment inventory and fear inventory and sex inventory with all of you, you know, keep this in mind. You know, when the third step says we are an agent, this is part of our agency here. Our very liberation liberates the people that are in our presence. And you will find this if you stick to people that are excited about recovery, that are excited about spiritual growth, that are excited about investigating the spiritual realm, it will be contagious. That's what I've done for 10.5 years. I do not hang out with middle-of-the-road people. I don't want anything they've got. Okay, I steer clear of them. I hang out with what I call the mad dogs. People who are curious and investigate and do this work year in and year out, and they want to go deeper, and they want to push the envelope, and they want to have a deeper, more meaningful experience with their creator. That's who I stick with. And then as a result, we've created this body of energy around us. It is contagious. I wish everybody caught it, but not everybody catches it.
Not everybody's supposed to.
Yeah, they're not supposed to. So, Brandon.
So, just in case you forgot, I'm Brandon, and I'm an alcoholic still. It's only how I identify. There's so much more to me than that. After the third step prayer, in the paragraph, there's this little part of a sentence that's fascinating. It says, "This was only a beginning." So all of what we've been talking about to this point, that's just the beginning, guys. We haven't even started tapping on the kids. So, when do we start the fourth step after saying the third step prayer? A guy asked this question in a meeting, was that one time. I had already shared. And I don't like double dipping because I think that it's completely... Well, it's completely selfish, but like, so this guy said, "Well, I said my third step prayer. When do I start the fourth step?" And he was getting all sorts of advice from people about when to start it, when they shared, and somebody was like, "Listen to your sponsor," and all this stuff, and I couldn't take it. I had to share again. I was like, "Well, if you go according to the book, right after the third step prayer, there's a paragraph, and then there's this word, bottom of page 63, that says, next." So I say the third step prayer. When do I start the fourth step?
Next.
That's pretty much right after, right? There's not a whole bunch of other stuff in between. It's now. And then it goes on and says, "We launched." We kind of moseyed into the fourth step. No, we launched. Taken off. On a course of vigorous. Like lots of action. Right? Oh, I'm just kind of going to walk over here into the four step. Hey, what's this about? No, go, go, go! The first step of which is a personal house cleaning. I don't want to look at that shit. Right? Though our decision, the prayer, was vital, life-giving, and crucial, it could have little... one day at a time effect. Oh, that's not what it says. Little permanent. I don't know that I said this last night, but like if I've got a leaking pipe, there's enough duct tape around my house to make that thing stop leaking for a little bit. But it's not going to stay stopped. If I want to fix that pipe so that it doesn't leak anymore, I got to like cut it, get some splices, new piece of pipe, and fix that shit for real. Then, if I did it properly, if I actually put the glue on after the primer on the PVC, which I've forgotten before, it should be fixed permanently. So if my intent is to just be sober one day at a time, the efforts I put in to fixing myself for one day are going to be significantly different than if I'm trying to fix it forever, permanently.
Not me, Dan.
Duct tape, go to the hardware store, get the right supplies, and fix it. That's what I want. So, permanent effect, unless followed at once by strenuous, that's, you know, you look up strenuous, it means just kind of like not very hard. Oh, it means the opposite of that. Strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things and myself, which had been blocking me. Blocking me from what? God knows about me. Which is really where God is anyways. Our liquor, our drugs, our meth, our pipes, our stems, they were just a symptom. We had to get down to the causes. Therefore, we started on a personal inventory. This was the fourth step. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. An alcoholic or addict, in Brandon's experience, that does not take regular inventory usually ends up drunk or high. Or miserable enough where you wish they would be drunk or high. You ever experience some people that are dry or just a little bit clean? Miserable people. But people that actually have done this work and continuously do this work and are serious about recovery, generally, I mean, I would say that most people that encounter me encounter a person that is likable and enjoyable if I'm not pissing them off. And sometimes I'm pissing them off by asking them questions that they don't want to hear. But generally, I think that I am very interested in life and I become an interesting person as a result of it. I didn't know that when I started my inventory. So, it's a fact-finding, which is the fourth step, and fact-facing, which is the fifth step process. It is an effort to discover the truth, okay? It is our light that scares us, not our darkness. If I actually live up to the potential that I know that I can, and I fail, we got problems. So what Brandon does is he just doesn't try and says, he's got lots of potential, I'm just not using it. Because then it's you know, I just didn't try. But where's my life doesn't get challenged, my life doesn't get better if I don't go out there and use my gifts. So I can't fool myself about the values. Okay? When we've done this work, when we've done 1, 2, and 3, we realize that I do a crappy job of living my life. And if I really looked at some of those things on pages 61 to 63, I'm convinced that self manifested in various ways is what has defeated me. So I consider the common manifestations. Resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics and addicts than anything else. I didn't say this before, but you know, when they wrote this book, they could have used any words in the English language to write this book. But they picked the words that they picked. So that means if they picked a word, I think that that's what they meant, because they could have used a different word if that's not what they meant. So when they say that resentment kills more alcoholics and addicts than anything else, you know what I think they mean? Resentment kills more alcoholics and addicts than anything else. Including alcohol and drugs. Wonder if it's important. And then from resentment, it stems all forms of spiritual disease. So all the other stuff that I experienced, that inward turmoil and angst and everything, comes out of resentment. That's what it says. Wonder why they said that. Maybe that's what they meant. For we have been not only mentally and physically ill, we've been spiritually sick. So they've been kind of teasing us with this spiritual thing. Now they're coming right out and saying it. When the spiritual maladies overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. What's funny is that if I watch people that aren't really serious about recovery, they want to straighten out the physical so that they can feel, they can think right, and then we'll deal with the spiritual later. And it never works for them.
I mean, think about it. What do most people do when they get into recovery, early recovery? They treat their body.
Mm-hmm.
Hit the gym. Get on that keto diet. Get on the paleo diet.
Start reading some stuff.
Oh, yoga.
Yeah.
Right? Right? What's that all about? I don't want to suffer. I don't want to struggle through my existence. I got to do everything so I can be comfortable. That's the culture we live in.
Get a job. If I just get a job, everything will be fine. And then I'm going to read a bunch of books or do something that I get mentally fixed. The fog's gone. by the time you do that, the spiritual doesn't matter anymore, guys. I actually asked the guy one time, we got up to inventory and he kind of disappeared. He finally called me one day and I said, is your life really so good that there, it can't improve in any way? And he actually said, yes. And I was like, well, shit, you don't need this anymore then. Now, that was, I think, let's see, I was in Tulsa, so that would have been 5 years ago. He's still not reworked the steps. And, like, he's one of those guys where if he's in a meeting, it's like you want to not sit close to him because the negative energy that comes off this guy. And he's tried to work the steps, I think, two other times with somebody else, and he just doesn't do it. Anyway. But he had a job and everything else. So in dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. We listed people, institutions, the police, the school, or principals. Principals are, oh, man. There's so many principles by which we live by.
Here, I got a few I can read off.
Yeah, fire some off there.
Here's some principles. I will never make the kind of money I desire. It's a code or value that I live by. This was two inventories ago. I will eventually fail the people that love me. Buried deep down inside of me, that was a principle that kept showing up. The belief that I am entitled and I deserve the best. The belief that control equals security. The belief that God owes me something. The belief that I have to be respected in order to live and breathe. The belief that I'm going to get what I want when I want in order to live. The belief that God will eventually fail me. The belief that my time is more important than your time. Those are principles.
You think that would cause any conflict with other people if you're living by those? Uh-huh. But it's their fault, right? Of course. So, we had to ask ourselves why we were angry. So, column one is the people I'm angry at. Column two is why I'm angry at them in my mind, right? Completely justifiable. Now we have the seven areas of self. We've got the self-esteem, which is the role I assign myself, who I think I am. I'll show you some of these in a minute. Our pocketbooks, time and money. Time and money that somebody else wastes. Ambition, what I want out of this situation. Then we've got over on page 65, we've got security, which is what I think I need to be okay. We got personal relationships. That's the deep-seated way that I think that this relationship's supposed to look. And then we have sex relations, which is how a real man or woman is supposed to be, or the way that I sometimes look at it is how, because I'm a guy that, like everything's, like, about how to look sexier other than what I do physically. It's just like the way I think. And so those are the seven areas. I got them all right, but I feel like I'm missing one. Pride. We get pride down. If you're on page 65, you look under wife down on the right, it says pride. Pride is how I want others to view me. Okay? Now, I'll tell you that as I've been here and I've gone through inventories, The two things that drive everything for me are pride and fear. Okay? But pride is really just fear because I want you to view me the way that I want to be viewed, that I want you to view me, which I'm afraid that you won't, so you need to really view me that way. If that got confusing. So it's really fear. But pride seems to show up a lot when I write inventory the way that I do. So that's the third column. Okay, and I'm gonna go through columns 1, 2, and 3 on two pieces of inventory that do not make Brandon look very good. Column 1, 2, and 3 don't make me look so bad, so it's not so bad. But when I get to column 4, you'll start to see how this guy thinks. So this is one of my kids. Column 1, kid number 1. Column 2, why I'm angry. because he's retarded and he frustrates me. Okay? Column three, self-esteem. Role I've assigned myself, and I'll tell you guys, the worse you look in column three, the more relief you're going to get out of this inventory, because the crazier I sound, the more that I can work through it. Self-esteem. I'm the perfect dad, son, human, period. Pride, how I want others to view me. Everyone should know, or everyone should follow my lead. Ambition, I want to rule the world. Like, and you write the stuff as it comes out of you, and you start to realize, it's like, I wrote that, and I was like, what? Security, everyone, including him, should fall in line and do as I think. Fulfillment of this need can be satisfied until I change my mind. Personal relations, a real kid acts like an adult. Sex relations. I mean, seriously? Sex relations, women find men with adult kids sexy. Pocketbook, the time I spend watching him fumble is wasted. Okay, so there's one with a close personal relationship. Then this one's with an employer. Okay, a specific guy. Self-esteem. I'm the fucking awesomest motherfucker ever. That's how I wrote it. Pride. Look at my resume. I am fucking awesome. Everyone. There's no power behind this resentment, is there, right? Like, he doesn't know who he's messing with. Ambition. I want millions without effort. Others should know this. Security. Isn't it obvious? Respect money. Respect equals money. Personal relations. A real man just has money. Look at these other individuals, other successful monetarily people. They are the real men. Sex relations. Money equals sex equals power. Pocketbook. Everyone is stealing my time and money. Okay?
This one.
What? Yeah.
So I'm going to read my first three columns on a piece of inventory. Now, I write inventory once a year. I'll probably be doing it here pretty soon. I imagine I'll be going through the work again. This was from last March. This was somebody who shall remain anonymous. He's slow, methodical. He rarely makes sense. He opposes viewpoints just to stir shit up.
Okay, you wouldn't like him either, would you?
All right. Self-esteem. You know, what role have I given myself? I'm a decisive and I'm a certain man. My pride. No one should hear an incompetent share by someone I mentor. No one led by me should ever oppose me. All right, so like when I write inventory, it's the first thing that comes. I don't sit there. I'm just like, okay, how do I want others to view me in this situation? What do I want out of this situation? I want him to go with the flow and refrain from speaking.
As long as it's my flow.
Security. I need competent men around me to be okay. Personal relationships. A real sponsee is confident, certain, and acts swiftly and takes charge. Sex relations. A real man moves quickly and with confidence and certainty. Pocketbook was not effective. So those are my first three columns.
Okay, so then we go back to the book and it says, we went back through our lives, nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. When we were finished, we considered it carefully. Okay, so this means that I need to kind of ponder this at a deeper level than I've ever pondered it. The first thing that was apparent is the world and its people were often quite wrong. Clearly, you listen to what we wrote. I mean, these guys are wrong. You think they're wrong. We think they're wrong. Everybody thinks they're wrong. To conclude that others were wrong is as far as most of us ever got. The usual outcome was the people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Sometimes it was remorse and we were sore on ourselves. But the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. As in war, the victor only seemed to win. Okay? So then there's a bunch more great writing, but we don't have time for it. And then we turn back to the list. This is, okay, so I'm not done with column three. Or I'm done with column three. Now I'm going back to the list, for it held the key to the future. So just a question. So do you think that, what do you think they mean when they say that we turn back to the list, for it held the key to the future? Do you think that, like, they actually mean that this list held the key to the future? Interesting. So it actually shows me how to get free of the resentment in the resentment. Why wouldn't you do this then? We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. We began to see that the world and its people really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoings of others, fancied or real, had the power to actually kill. All of my resentments are fancied. Because the minute I take it into my head, I start to change the experience to make it more beneficial to me. I will share it with Will. When I share it with Will, I'll find out what works, what fires him up. Then I share it with Tarek. When I find out from Tarek what fires him up, then I share it with Josh. Then I share it with Ryan. By the time I get done with it, it doesn't look anything like what really happened, but it makes me look really good. So everything I experience is fancy all the time. And I know that now. So I think I'm disturbed. I'm not really disturbed. I just think I'm disturbed. We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? This was our course. We realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. I don't like the idea of this looking at our part in things.
Oh.
Because if this is the entire situation, you know what my part looks like? Right there. This is yours. This is mine. So when I'm looking at resentment, all I'm looking at is 100% of this piece. That's it. I don't care about any of this. Where have I been selfish? Where have I been self-seeking? Where have I been frightened? Where have I been dishonest? Column 4, that's what I'm looking at. Okay? So here's some examples. Column 4, same resentment. Kid number 1, fear. My thoughts, needs, wants, desires are not met. I cannot be happy. Dishonest. Ugh, I don't like this one. I have little or no faith that when I say he is on his own path, I actually believe it. Instead, I secretly wish everyone will do as I think and be ready to change direction at a moment's notice, even though I know that I have flawed thinking. That's not very fun. Selfish. I only care about me and what goes on in my head. I never like reading this one. Self-seeking. I build walls of arrogance and indifference to generate a feeling of superiority simply as a defense mechanism to protect me from what thinking I know is flawed. I have a sense of arrogance that protects me from being truly authentic with anyone I meet. Then I cry that nobody understands me and walk around in self-pity, waiting for the world to change instead of taking the necessary action to improve my life.
You want to?
I can read this one.
Oh, go ahead.
It still chokes me up when I read it because I see that this inventory was written in February of 2016. Here we are 2 years later and that shit still happens. It's better. It still happens. The difference is I see it for what it is today. Alright, here's back to the boss. People are justified to fire me, and if I'm not as cool as I think I am, and I'm not as cool as I think I am in my head. I'm dishonest because I walk around with arrogance instead of trying to be of service to God's children. I am always trying to find ways to get other people's money. Selfish. I have almost no ability to see anyone else in my life. Self-seeking. Minimal effort, expecting maximum results. Right inventory to see the insanity of my mind. When the insanity is apparent, I can see the connection to my insane mind, and I use to make decisions with on a daily basis. If I truly understand that my mind, when insane, I may think a drink looks like a solution instead of a problem. This is why I must continue to write inventory. You know, I wrote that about one specific boss, and then I asked myself the question at the end. Has this shown up with any other employers? Only 7.
So I'm about to read you the fourth column from that piece of inventory, but there's a bridge between the third and fourth column. It's page 66 and 67. It says, perhaps these individuals who have disturbed us are perhaps spiritually sick. So we ask God to help us show them the same patience, tolerance, and pity that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. Now, the guys that I sponsor, when they write inventory, after the third column, they have to say that prayer. Because that's how you look at things from an entirely different angle. You have to have access to power in order to write the fourth column. That's just what I have found. Otherwise, it's a struggle to write the fourth column, because that's how we look at things from an entirely different angle. The big book says that we are to set aside entirely what the other person did. And we are to resolutely look for our own faults and our own mistakes. Nowhere does it say I'm going to look for my part. But that is the most watered down piece of AA and CA that I ever hear, and HA. And they say it in all the meetings, my part, my part, my part. Well, you know where it's going to mess you up is when you get your nine-step amends and you got this expectation of you coming to clean your part up, and naturally the other person's going to clean their part up, and they don't clean their part up, and you walk out of the amends with a resentment, specifically when they've wronged you way more than you've wronged them. That's why we can't do that. We only can look at where mistakes and where we were at fault. So in this resentment, my fear, I have three basic fears. I don't want to look bad, and this guy for some reason is making me look bad. I'm afraid of what others think, and I'm afraid of confrontation, okay, because I don't want to talk to him about it. What's the dishonesty? I lied to him about what I thought about his talks and his shares. Delusion. That he's not useful to other people. That's not true. Helps a lot of guys. Selfish attitude. I focus on his behavior, how his behavior affects me, and what I want to do or what others think about me as a result of how he shows up. I'm constantly self-focused, self-absorbed. Self-seeking action. I want him to be different so I don't experience discomfort and go down a path I don't agree with. Right. So instead of having an honest dialogue with him, I'll just be real submissive, but then I'm boiling inside. Right. My toes are curling in my shoes. And so that's the truth. Now, is there an amends to make there? No, because in our relationship, we're fine. I'm not going to go and confront him about this. That's like that guy that told you you were an asshole and he wanted to make amends to it and you had no idea about it, right?
Okay. We'll talk about that one later. How not to make an amends.
Yeah, if nobody knows that you think they're an asshole, don't go make amends to them. Hey, man, I want to make amends to you. For the longest time, I thought you were an asshole. It's like, okay, you just created some harm, but, you know, who the hell's your sponsor?
It used to be this guy.
Yeah. All right, Matt, go ahead.
No, you're...
am I up now?
I think so.
Okay.
Well, so it's plain to see that a life which includes deep resentment only leads to futility and unhappiness, right? I write this stuff, I see it for what it is. What I write in column four makes everything else a lie. These people aren't really this way. They're fine. When I'm spiritually fit, you can't touch me. The most insane stuff can happen to you in a spiritually fit state of mind, and you're fine. If I'm disturbed, I ain't fine. I need to look at it.
Mm.
Fear.
So I'm bottom of page 67. So when I write fear inventory, I go back to my fourth column. My fourth column has fear in it, so I just make a list on a separate sheet of paper of all the fears that I have. Right? And then I ask myself why I have the fear. Notice the word fear is bracketed alongside difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employer, and the wife. Mr. Brown, by the way, should have his ass kicked. This, you guys know why he should have his ass kicked?
Let's talk on the other page.
Man, he had attention to Bill's wife. He told Bill's wife about the mistress, and he might get Bill's job at the office. He should have his ass
kicked.
Somebody
needs to get their ass kicked.
Man, you guys are a rough crowd, man. Y'all are.
We're gonna be like after dinner. Y'all get some food in there. Oh.
This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It's an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence is shot through with it. The word shot in the 1939 dictionary says weaving method that makes it difficult to look at where find out where something starts or where something finishes. So you can't see it. It's just interwoven in your existence, and you're living with it, and you don't even know it half the time.
It's part of the fabric.
It sets in motion trains of circumstances which bring misfortune you feel you don't deserve. But didn't you yourself get the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. Do not ask me what that means, because I have never figured it out. We reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper, even though we had no resentment in connection with them. We asked ourselves why we had them. Wasn't it because self-reliance had failed? Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it doesn't go far enough. Some of us have had great self-confidence, but it doesn't fully solve the fear problem or any other. When it made us cocky, that's even worse. Well, perhaps there's a better way. We think so. So what they're saying is there a better way than self-reliance. For we are now on a different basis, foundation, the basis and foundation of trusting and relying upon a God of our understanding. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role God assigns. See, our problem is we want to play the roles we want to assign. Just to the extent that we do as we think God would have us do and humbly rely on God, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity? So this is vision work. You know, we truly don't know, but we want to create a vision of how we would envision our Creator wanting us to show up in certain situations.
So let's assume that you had a map of the universe and you actually knew how to read it and why everything happens the way that it does. Then you could probably understand why the things are happening in your life the way that they're happening. But because you don't have a map of the universe or why things are happening, it's difficult to accept that there's a purpose in what's happening. But if you could see the rest of it, you might understand why it was happening. So in short, shut the hell up and deal with it.
We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men and women of faith have courage. They trust their God. They never apologize for God. Instead, we let Him, God, demonstrate. I have a hard problem letting God do anything. It's God. It's not like I can. Oh God, it's okay. You can do this now. I don't think it works like that. I'd rather have that say, God demonstrates through me what He can do. God demonstrates through me what she can do. We ask God to remove our fears and direct our attention to what He would have us be. At once we commence to outgrow fear. That's a conditional prayer. For a while, I talk about this. Conditional means this will happen if you do this. So these fears, when I say a fear, God, please remove my fear, direct my attention to what you would have me be. I immediately attempt to become a state of consciousness that cannot exist with that fear. Okay? And that might be a temporary, quote-unquote, fix. And then like 10 minutes later, my fear of not having enough money returns. Again, I say that prayer, God, please remove my fear of financial insecurity and direct my attention to what you would have me be, and I become trusting, I become confident, I become taken care of, and then I move back to what I was doing. An hour later, the fear comes back, and I do the prayer again. Now I'm describing a 10-step as well, but this is why it's conditional, because it doesn't say that fears aren't going to come through us, but we're going to develop faith as we continue to become the states of being or the states of consciousness that don't exist with the fear. If you are being confident, there's no fear. If you are becoming trusting, there's no fear. But the thing is, we live in this world where, the fear is going to come back. It's not like we make a decision to become fearful. It has its own volition. It shows up on its own. And so when it shows up on its own, we have a practice. God, remove this fear and direct my attention to what you would have me be. Right? And the beautiful part is now you begin a dialogue with God on a regular basis. And this is how you develop a personal relationship with a God of your understanding.
And then intuitive thought shows up and says, call this person, call that person, go here, do this, go there, do that. And all of a sudden you're following these directions as a result of the fear prayer. and you start calling, hey man, I'm supposed to call you about a job, and the person goes, well, that's weird, I've never thought about hiring you before. Wonder what that would look like. And then you have this actual conversation that Brandon had with somebody. I was in a place where I needed some money. I was working for myself. I needed a job. I was on a ladder. My thought said, call Alex. So I climbed down off the ladder. Up on the ladder, I said, God, please remove my fear of insecurity. Direct my attention to what you'd have me be. Thought that comes is, call Alex. Climb down off the ladder. Call Alex. Alex, I'm supposed to call you about a job. I've never thought about that. Ended up having several conversations. We had some strategy sessions. I didn't get a job from him, but it kind of pushed me a different direction where some money started coming in some other ways. Just because you are where you are, it doesn't mean that's where you're going to end up. Sometimes you go somewhere to look at something from a different perspective. That's it. Accept that.
So there are different ways to... There's a four-column fear inventory that's in the big book. What's the fear? Why do you have the fear? How do you set the ball rolling? What perhaps is a better way? Four columns. Last year, I did a simple two-column inventory. What's the fear and why do I have the fear? Here's some of them. Being alone. Why do I have this fear? I'll smoke crack, then I'll die, and I'll die without any human interaction because I don't believe God's always there. Okay. I'm afraid of being wrong. Why? Because I will lose my influence and my status. I don't trust God. Financial insecurity. Why? Life will become more difficult and I'll have to trust God even more. Yes. I'm afraid of seeing myself in my mother. Why? I hate the idea of exhibiting the same character attributes as she does, but I do from time to time. Why? Because I forget God's molding me. Okay. To me, it's all about going back and seeing the absence of God, and that's why I'm afraid. So, that's an example of fear inventory. Do we have any questions?
What would you explain B as again?
Yeah.
Like a state of being, like confident, trusting, secure
in that moment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the prayer, so we ask God, anytime you see the word ask in the book, it's a prayer. We ask God to remove our fear and direct our attention to what God would have us be. So what that looks like for me is, God, please remove my fear of financial insecurity and direct me to what you would have me be. Then gives the idea of, call this guy for a job. Okay, that's the response to the prayer. Do this. Okay, B, open it. It can be anything, right? And so it's just what you're doing is, it's kind of like that prayer in the morning of saying, God, please reveal yourself to me over the course of the day. You're looking for it. You say this prayer, you stuff's going to come. And it's going to be stuff that you might not have thought about otherwise. That's why the prayer is so powerful. It's because it opens you up. Mold me, shape me, be what you... Show me whatever it is. I mean, this prayer is one of the most magical prayers in the book, period. It's short and sweet. I use it all the time. I find myself all banged up about, well, I'm in traffic, I'm not going to be there on time. God, please remove my fear about being late and direct my attention to what you'd have me be. And I'm sitting there and it's like, get in the right lane. Get in the right lane. And fly by all the traffic. And it's like, whoa, that was weird. Happens all the time. Okay? So, I did fear kind of a funky little way. You've been here for a little while, you're going to start playing with some things, and I did fear in a different way. I looked at all the things that I wasn't doing in my life that I knew I should be doing, and I knew that there was fear behind it. Okay, and so I had a list of about 15 things that I just wasn't doing and was avoiding like the plague, because that's what I do. And one of them was submitting proposals. Okay, and the fear, why do I have the fear, was my proposals might be rejected or I would be viewed as unprofessional. Okay? I'm not going to read all of it, but pride, I want others to see me and seek me out and consider me reliable, right? In a work setting. So, dishonesty, I'm unreliable and not recommended because I do not submit proposals. I want everything without any effort. I expect others to pay me more for no reason. So I'm reading this inventory to a guy. This one's an old piece. He goes, so Brandon, let me get this straight. Let me see if this sounds right. I want to do average work and get credit for the best work. Mike, it sounds really bad when you say it that way. But what I realized through this piece of fear inventory is that the thing that I'm afraid of by taking no action always happens. I don't want to submit proposals because I don't want them to be rejected. I don't want to be viewed as unprofessional. What happens when I don't submit proposals? I'm unprofessional and I don't get the work. If you look at every piece of fear, the thing that you're afraid of is happening right now as a result of the fear. Because you're unwilling to look at it. Every time. If you find one that doesn't apply, come get with me. I'm fascinated by it. Because every time, the thing I'm afraid of the most, I'm generating in my life. Not writing inventory. Continue to be miserable. What if you write inventory? You might not be miserable. No, that can't happen. Okay, you're right.
Now about sex. I'm going to go to page 69.
He's not making this shit up. It's really page 69.
You know, I was doing one of these three-day deals last weekend and talking to a few people in attendance, and I was fascinated by how many people had no idea the sex inventory was in the big book. Yeah. So
Bill knew that it was never.
So let's talk about this. We're going to review our conduct over years past. Where had we been selfish? That's the first question.
Ooh.
Where have we been dishonest? That's the second question. Where have we been inconsiderate? That's the third question. Whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, bitterness? Where were we at fault? And what should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and looked at it. It's nine questions. Nine questions, folks. But look, you know, recently I've discovered a new way. I used to, like, come up with this list. I had one guy say, I want you to pray. I don't care if it's men and women. You know, sex inventory typically is about the sex you're attracted to and the relationships you've been in, and you inventory them. Over the years, I've noticed something. I may have six or seven people on the inventory, but the answers to all the questions are the same. How I'm inconsiderate tends to be the same with everybody. How am I selfish tends to be the same with everybody. Okay? Whom have I hurt may be different from situation to situation, but bitterness, suspicion, all that stuff tends to look very similar. And so I was listening to this guy, Don Pritz, talk about this inventory, and he goes, the list will make itself. And so he says, you just answer the question. Where had you been selfish? You list out the names of the people. Where have you been dishonest? You list out the names of the people because it's always there. How, you know, where were you inconsiderate? That's the list. I never looked at it that way. It simplifies resentment inventory. Even, I mean, not resentment, the sex inventory, but even with resentment, who in here has written resentment inventory? Okay. Have any of y'all written the extended third column that we showed you guys and how to write out how your self-esteem was affected, write out how your pride was affected? Have you ever noticed after like 10 to 15 resentments, it's all the same after that?
Blah, 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 blah. And so, but I'm important and very special and so different.
And, you know, this is the one thing, like, something, and I wrote a one-inch four-step when I first got sober with doing Joe and Charlie checklist, but, like, now... You know, I tell guys, I don't need a lot of resentments. If you come up with 50 resentments when you do your list, like I have guys, hey, 30 minutes on your timer, whatever comes off the pen, that's it, we're done. We're not writing anymore. I don't need a lot of resentments to get at your grosser handicaps.
after 12 to 15 probably, you've got a good idea what your grosser handicaps are. You see where your imperfection is. Now you can say, look, I haven't been able to do much to remedy the situation. And now we got something to go to God with in 6 and 7. Right? But I see people write these colossal missteps all the time.
Forever.
Yeah. It feeds the problem sometimes. You know, but I did it. I got sober on it. I'm not bashing it. You know, I'm sitting here because of it. I've just, you know, I have experience now, so my deal is to share, you know, best practices with you. But I don't let the guys I sponsor write those massive inventories. I just need to do something with you so we can get at your character grosser handicap.
If you're only going to write one inventory in your life, it has to be perfect. Has to be. If you're going to do this on a regular basis, you catch it on the next pass around. And so, Tarek and I, as you can probably tell, we're not believers in the fact that you write inventory once and then you do 10, 11, and 12 to maintain your sobriety. We just don't believe that. I don't know how that's done because I have no experience with it. We write inventory on a regular basis, and we don't just write inventory on a regular basis. We go all the way back to the first step. Where am I powerless today? In what areas of my life? And I take those all the way through the first 9 steps. Then it's not so important that I got everybody down on my list in my first 4 step, because I'm probably going to do it again. Okay? The only wrong way to do a 4 step is to not do it.
Mm-hmm.
If you're doing something, you're in action, you're moving, an effect will be produced.
Mm. And I'm glad.
So right.
I'm so glad you just said that. I don't want you guys walking away from this thinking this is the type of inventory and this is the be-all and the end-all. He's absolutely right. People are relapsing and dying because they're not writing any type of inventory. You know, so that's the important thing here is write inventory. You know, see how your troubles are all of your own making, and that's where your freedom is, because that tells you that, you know, the world and the people in it don't have to change for you to be okay. That's the important thing to take away from inventory.
We're talking on multiple levels over the course of this weekend. We're talking on the base level. We're talking all the way up to, like, there's things that we're throwing in that there's very few people understand what we're saying. And that's okay, because we're talking to them. Then there's people that we're just talking at the real base. We're talking to them. We're talking to the whole range. You want to, the way that we are effective is if we're throwing little crumbles of things out there that are so far beyond your comprehension right now, for one purpose for most of you, is so that you realize that there is something more beyond your comprehension.
Mm.
That's it. You don't need to understand all of what we're saying. You don't need to write inventory the way that we're writing it. You need to do this stuff, and then you start to explore, and you will be taken to teachers that will challenge you to do more.
Mm. Thank you, B. So after we answer these 9 questions, the most important question is, what should I have done instead? And it's never not get involved, okay? If you answer these questions, you know, and you write down, yeah, this is how I lied, and this is who I lied to, and this is how I was inconsiderate. Typically, it's the same in the relationships, and who did we hurt, and how did I arouse jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness? So you're gonna come up with a list of really crappy things, right? So here's the answer, really simple. Just do the opposite going forward. Right?
If you're unfaithful, what should you have done instead? That's right.
If you lie, you tell the truth. If you don't communicate, you start communicating. If you withhold your love to punish, you try not to do that. It's just doing the opposite. We don't need to make this difficult. And so it says, in this way, you're going to try to shape a sane and sound ideal for your future sex life. Subject each relationship to the test. Was it selfish or not? We ask God in prayer to help us mold our ideals and live up to them. That's all this is, an ideal. So look, I was with a woman for 7 years, very happy for about 5.5 of those years, maybe. I think close to 5.5. And I did this thing where I would go through the steps, I'd have my ideal, and I would share it with Marcy. Like every 3 months, I would ask her for a report card. And the interesting thing is, like right around that 3 month mark is the part where I started to stray away from the ideal, and she would like reel me back in and say, "You're not doing this, you're not doing that." And we were really happy in all those years. And then our marriage fell apart, and it was no one's fault. It was just things happened. You know, we both took our responsibility, and we've been divorced, and we're still friends, and we didn't use lawyers. It was actually, you know, but what I learned here allowed me to do that. But what I noticed was that last year and a half, there was no sharing of ideal, right? So is it, you know, I'm not fascinated or surprised that my marriage fell apart. You know, because I wasn't using this anymore. That's, you know, when the guys I sponsor write an ideal, I tell them to share it with their spouse, right? Share it with the spouse. And then ask her if she's willing to give you a report card about it. And then if you really got some courage, you post it in the kitchen on the refrigerator just so it sits there. Right?
So this is fascinating to listen to, because I'll tell you guys, this show is a morph and a changing and that I've not been aware of. Because I think the last time we did one of these workshops, I talked about sharing the ideal, and you cautioned against it because you said it could bring the end to your marriage. And now you're up here realizing how the troubles are of your own making because you stopped doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so this, like, I had to give the alternate perspective to what I was lining up, getting ready to give the alternate perspective on what Tarek was saying, but then I realized, wait, he's saying the same thing you say. And so the readiness to change our old ideas is what makes people on the spiritual path powerful. Tarek has changed his mind on this specific thing. Since when did we do our last one?
October? August.
August. So in 6 months, he's changed his mind again. And that's okay. He's not afraid of what people will think of him by changing his mind.
Mm-hmm.
He's speaking his current truth right now. Fascinating.
So that's the last piece, really, the inventory, is to write the sane and sound ideal for your future sex life. Now, here's an interesting exercise if you guys are thinking about getting into the relationship. Write down the 20 attributes you're looking for in a partner. Cross out the bottom 10, and you're left with the top 10, and see if the person you're thinking about getting into a relationship with has those 10 qualities. Okay? That's how you do an ideal for the person you're looking for. There's an ideal for how you want to be in a relationship, but before that, you got to get into a relationship, so maybe live by that ideal. That's another practice that, you know, my buddy Chris shared with us years ago, and I share it with guys. I've done it myself.
And there's a ton of work in the around these pages 68 through 71 that you can apply in all areas of your life. I take through the steps. I don't have them just write an ideal of their sane, sound sex relationship. I have them write ideals around work. If they're parents, how do you look around the relationship with your kids? Have them write these ideals, because you know what? The craziest thing is we walk around with these ideas in our head of how we want things to be, but we never identify them or write them down.
Mm.
I want this kind of job. Did you ever write that down? Did you ever put that in your vision work of how to become that? Well, no. How are you going to get there? How are you going to know when you're even there? You don't have anything to reflect back on.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do the... I tell people to do 20-10-5. Write 20 things. Cut it down to 10. Cut it down to 5. You got a list of 5 things. If you're going into a relationship, you're going into a job that doesn't have at least 3 of those 5, run like hell. You're getting a failing grade right out of the gate.
Yeah, but I had an epiphany as I'm listening to Brandon. So I did this exercise with my wife before, you know, as at the beginning of our relationship. I remember out of the 10, I think she had 8 or 9. But she was missing the most important one. Now, one of the things I had on there was my partner would be active in spiritual growth and recovery. She wasn't.
Deal breakers.
Yeah. She wasn't in the program. And she partied a lot. And ultimately, that's not the only reason our marriage fell apart. But it was the most important thing on my list. Didn't know it was a deal breaker at the time. You know, deal breakers negate. You got 100 things, right? One deal breaker, the other 99, I don't care if they're positive, they are automatically negated. That's why it's called the deal breaker. Did I overlook the deal breaker?
And a lot of the practices we're talking about, be careful with some of these things. Don't do the 2010-5 if you're in a relationship on your current relationship and then start thinking that you shouldn't be in the relationship. I mean, there are so many things that we're talking about up here which are general practices. Don't go perform surgery on yourself. Talk with somebody first that's done it. And don't do it anyway. But so, if you want to explore some of these things, talk through them with us. Get more on the details on anything that we're talking about, because some of it, you should not go into your head alone, ever.
No. So
it's a scary place.
Inventory. A lot of people think it's about finding out who you are. It's not. It's about finding out what's blocking you from yourself, what's blocking you from connecting with other people, and what's blocking you from connecting with God, the God within and the God without. It's also about discovering the lies. You know, Brandon and I, a lot of the stuff we read, they're lies that are buried in our unconscious mind that we're not aware of, but they're still driving our behaviors. All right? And they end up driving our conscious decisions. And so that's what inventory is about. It's finding out who you're not, really. And at the end of the day, it's like you're going through an archaeological dig. And you're just sculpting away, or God's doing the sculpting, you know, and he's chipping away at everything that's not Tarek. And ultimately, maybe at the end, there'll be something closer to what Tarek should be. I don't know. But inventory is a really cool process. If you have any questions, get with us. We are done until 7 o'clock.
No way! We got supper at 5:30. The church got a home-cooked meal for us. So